Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Seth Axelrod, and I'll be moderating tonight's call. I am delighted to welcome you to our presentation with Dr. Kenneth Silk, who will be generously sharing his expertise with us on issues related to prescribing medications and borderline personality disorder. To start, just a few brief administrative details. If you are registered for the call-in series, you should have received an email with slides. So please download the handout now if you haven't done so already or if you don't have it on your computer screen. We at NEABPD would like to express our great appreciation to the Gunderson residents at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts and the Clearview Treatment Program in Venice, California, who are generously helping to sponsor this program. We hope individuals on the call will also show support to this and other NEABPD programs by making a donation of any amount. This will help to continue the call-in series as well as future programs. You can do this on the website at borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com, or you can click on the link in the newsletter you received. During our call, please email your questions to neabpd@aol.com. Your questions will come to me, and I'll get to as many as possible during tonight's call. Again, that's emailing neabpd@aol.com. We'll finish the call promptly by 9 p.m. As always, the audio and slides for the call will be archived at borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. There's also an article of Dr. Silk that's posted that covers many of the topics that will be discussed this evening. So please feel free to pass on the link to people in your network who couldn't make it tonight. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Kenneth Silk, a board-certified psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry at the University of Michigan, where he directs the Personality Disorders Program for the U of M Health System. He's a fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. He's a graduate of Albert Einstein School of Medicine at Yeshiva, and he completed psychiatry residency at the Yale School of Medicine. He is a prolific author of articles and books, chapters in the areas of personality disorders, and he has specific expertise in psychopharmacology of borderline personality disorder. He is also the science editor and a member of the scientific advisory board for the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. So we are very grateful for that. We are absolutely delighted to have Dr. Silk presenting, Ask the Doctor, Medication, and More. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Ken Silk.
Well, thanks. Good evening, everybody, and thank you for spending a small part of your Sunday night here with us. I want to jump right in to give you some background about myself and how I think about the issue. So as Seth said, I'm a psychiatrist. I did inpatient psychiatry for 20 years, and then I ran an outpatient team that focused on personality disorders for an additional 20 years here at the University of Michigan Health System. When one thinks about medication and borderline personality disorder, it's, as you probably know, and I know looking at some of the questions that Seth has provided me with, that it's not a simple issue. But there are some people who believe that one should never use medications with people with borderline personality disorder, or if you use them, you should use them very, very briefly, because the evidence for effectiveness in people with borderline personality disorder is pretty weak, or I could say moderate at best. But there are other people who are very, let me say, enthusiastic. I like the phrase over-enthusiastic psychopharmacologist about using medications in patients with borderline personality disorder. And there's this belief that if one can find the right medication and or medication cocktail, that somehow we can kind of beat this disorder. And I guess my position is that we need to use medications cautiously. We should use them on a trial and error basis. We should try and switch medications rather than augment one medication with another medication. But it should all be done with the understanding that medications really a lot less effective in this disorder than we would wish them to be. And that in general, most of the problems that one deals with and most of the behavioral and affective or mood, if I can put it that way, disruptions that occur are things that we don't have medications that seem to work very effectively in those situations. And by sticking with the therapy that one is in and working hard at the therapy and trying to figure out what is the insult or the provocation that led to the behavioral or emotional disruption, that there's more going to be more money in that bank than in the bank of trying to be an overenthusiastic psychopharmacologist or throwing a medication at a patient every time things seem to deteriorate or get worse. So if one looks at the data with respect to effectiveness of medication, which I've done and other people have done, I think that that's the wisest position. So that's the position from which I try and make my decisions. Certainly if there were a medication that could work, that we would really, it would really be out there and we could all be buying stocks in the company that makes it. But at the moment, we really don't, we don't really have the evidence that, that medications and particularly multiple medications simultaneously work. And guidelines, from Australia, from the United Kingdom, and from the United States, suggest that medication should be adjunctive to therapy, and essentially while they might be able to help and round out some of the sharp edges that there isn't a medication that's that is curative for borderline personality disorder. So that's my introduction, Seth.
That's great. What we'll do, thank you very much for that introduction and those initial points. And what we'll do is I'm going to follow up with a few things you said already to try to get more clarification and to hear more about it. I'm going to start with some broad questions. You've been already speaking about some of the guidelines, some of the accepted wisdom. There isn't a medication for borderline, and yet patients end up on lots of medications. It's kind of chasing a cocktail seems to occur. So there seems to be a bit of a disjunct between kind of best practices of what you said, single medication replace rather than augment versus what tends to happen. So I'd like to start with some questions for you that have to do with some of the challenges of polypharmacy. And I'll also raise some questions about specific medications. And some of those have already started coming in. One is, at least I think the very common experience is individuals with borderline end up being prescribed many medications, four or five medications, for different kinds of symptoms. Is there something you'd recommend an individual with borderline or their prescriber if they are starting new and they're already prescribed several medications, maybe five medications? What would you recommend?
Well, gosh, let me go in a different direction. If a person came to me on five medications and they still felt like that they the medications weren't necessarily helpful for them, I would try and decrease the number of medications the patient was on for two different reasons. If you're on five medications, at least to a psychiatrist, I would not want to be the person that adds the sixth medication to the cocktail. So I would try and address with the individual about whether or not they thought that things were better when they were on medications than when they were off medications. And if things seemed to be better when they were on medications, did they have any sense as to which one of those medications or which two of those medications can they make a reasonable guess might be most helpful to them. And at that point in time, I think that I would begin to work with the patient on trying to reduce the number of medications, and I would try and work in collaboration with the patient as to choosing at least the first medication that we would try and decrease and then eliminate. And I would make a promise that if when we reduce the medications, the person thought that, or as we were reducing the medication, the individual thought that things were getting worse, then I might try and determine whether that was a withdrawal or a discontinuation symptom. That's really a withdrawal symptom. Whether that's the anxiety of the patient showing up because the individual feels like I need to be on five and I can't really be on four, and I would want to explore that. And I might step up 50% from where I was. So if I went down, let's say someone was on 200 of something and we went to 100 and they thought that things were more difficult, I might then go back up to 150 to see whether or not things would be go more smoothly then, and then go back down to 100, or have a discussion with the patient that perhaps we are choosing the wrong medication to decrease at this point in time. The real issue here is if somebody comes in on five medications, we don't know whether what it is that they're feeling and experiencing is the result of some of the side effects of the medications. And that to get someone, let's say, even from five medications to two medications, that's going to take a long time. It's not going to take a month. It may take anywhere between 3 months and 7 or 8 months to get there. And I would want to explain all that before I began to decrease the medication.
Is that something in particular that you suggest discussing with the patient, how long the process takes to do these various changes that you're talking about? It seems that often the prescriber and the patient, at least in my own experience, often end up on kind of different pages on, you know, how long is enough before making the next change. Is that particularly challenging with working with borderline personality disorder, do you think?
Well, I would try and, you know, what I would try and do is get an agreement on what the goal is, and then discuss how long I think it would take to reach that goal, though it might take longer or much longer than I suggest, or that the patient may be able to tolerate or not experience increased symptoms if we went down more rapidly. But it would really be a collaborative effort. It would be very difficult to say that I am going to reduce you from five to two medications, and you're going to just have to bite the bullet and suffer to get there. I would never approach it that way. I would approach it that over the next X number of months, our goal is to have you on less medications, and we can go as slowly or as fast as you can tolerate and what your body can tolerate.
And it sounds like there were several issues there. One is, are the symptoms getting worse because a medication has stopped? One is a discontinuation syndrome, and one is simply an anxiety related to a change.
Right.
The person's gotten used to being on it. Am I getting that right?
You got it right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's very complicated.
So that, you know, if a person's in therapy and then they're seeing a psychiatrist or a psychopharmacologist, and that person is simply spending 10 minutes talking about, well, this is what we're going to do this week, and this is what we're going to do next week, and doesn't spend time with the patient trying to understand and discuss what the experience of lowering the medication is for the patient, then it will be unsuccessful. But that doesn't mean that the psychiatrist needs to meet a half an hour every week, particularly if a person has a therapist, but to, you know, maybe meet once a month for 30 minutes, work out a plan. In my practice, I'm always available for by email if people have concerns about what the medication is doing or not doing for them. And so in that way, I think if people believe that there's open communication and that the psychiatrist can hear what they say, it's no different than validation, then I think some of the anxiety that people feel will be decreased. I often think that borderline patients feel like that the world denies them what it is that they need. Mm. And you don't want to get caught in the trap that or be seen by the patient as, well, this doc is just another doc that isn't giving me what I need. In fact, he's taking away what I need. So those issues need to be joined before the process has really begun.
Yeah, so there's a lot more going on than simply the medication question itself. It's a lot of, that collaboration, that discussion, and what the patient's experience of it is very central.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I want to ask a couple more questions related to the polypharmacy, and then I'm going to move in the direction of some specific medications. One is something you said in your introduction is really about the modest effect that medications tend to have in treating borderline personality disorder, and that's on one hand. On the other hand, you've got the prescribers who are kind of chasing, trying to get maybe a bigger effect by introducing more medications, changing medications, adding medications. Any recommendations for how the prescriber and the individual would know to be satisfied with kind of a here's a medication with a modest effect as opposed to continuing to try to do better with more? It just seems like there's a tension there.
Well, there is a tension, but I guess that I would go back. If I was starting someone on medication, I would go back and talk about the fact that in people with borderline personality disorder, and I think it's really, really important that in doing this, that it be acknowledged that either that the patient does have borderline personality disorder or that you, in this instance, I, as the psychiatrist, am thinking about the medications and thinking about the patient in the context of borderline personality disorder, and that what we know is, for whatever reason, that even symptoms of anxiety and depression, which can be quite medication responsive when borderline personality disorder is not present, that the medications seem to be less effective in the presence of borderline personality disorder. So we can expect less effectiveness. That doesn't mean we don't try it, but that there are many, as you said before, this is a complex disorder, and there are many other things that are going on at the same time that are impacting mood, behavior, reactions, anxiety and depression, to put it simply, and that for whatever reason, people with borderline personality disorder seem to be more troubled by the side effects. So I often discuss this as a kind of cost-benefit ratio, that if you didn't have borderline personality disorder, the benefits for a given drug seem to be pretty good, and patients without borderline personality disorder in general seem to be less sensitive to side effects than patients with borderline personality disorder. But then when you add borderline personality disorder, what happens is the tendency to experience side effects increases, and the effectiveness, for whatever reason, of the medication is more moderated, and so the cost-benefit ratio changes. That doesn't mean that it shouldn't be tried, but then if one's an overenthusiastic psychopharmacologist, one doesn't realize that the cost-benefit ratio is changed, and that's when one begins to add more and more medications, thinking they can make it be as good as if the person didn't have BPD, and in my experience, that just doesn't happen.
One final question on the polypharmacy specifically that I wanted to raise is individuals with borderline typically are complex, multi-problem individuals. They often have many diagnoses. They might have, in addition to borderline, major depressive disorder, PTSD, ADHD. Any thoughts about that, about efforts to keep the prescribing simple in the face of maybe there are three or four clinical diagnoses?
In the questions you sent me, that those were the ones I was trying to figure out how best to answer it. I guess that when one starts on a course with a psychiatrist in the treatment of borderline personality disorder with or without comorbidities, other disorders, I think you need to sit down with the patient, discuss what the other possible diagnoses are, and reach some sort of agreement with the patient that which of the diagnoses is most prominent or most troublesome, and which of the diagnoses are we going to try to treat pharmacologically. Because the easiest way to get to polypharmacy is to give a psychostimulant for the ADD, perhaps give an SSRI, high-dose sertraline for the PTSD, a mood stabilizer for the BPD, and something else. And that is not going to be useful. So that you're going to have to figure out what is it that we're going to focus on, not that we're going to ignore the other ones. But in order to make progress, we need to look at one thing and try and focus on that one thing. That doesn't mean that in the individual therapy, one can't be looking at the PTSD issues, one can't be doing some CBT for some of the ADHD issues, but I think when you start, you have to decide what's the most prominent diagnosis. You know, the CLIP study, the collaborative study for personality disorders, for those yeah. listening, that was a five-site study looking at a number of personality disorders. They found that what was very, very useful and helpful is if a person's in a major depressive episode and they do have borderline personality disorder, making the borderline personality disorder better helps get the major depressive disorder better. Trying to treat the major depressive disorder as if the borderline personality disorder didn't exist leads to only partial treatment of the major depressive disorder and no improvement in the borderline personality disorder. So that's what I would mean when I said that you would have to kind of sit down with the patient and talk about these things and say, look, this is the strategy I would like to take. Now, if the patient says, no, I don't want to take this strategy, then you sit down and figure out what's a strategy that both of you can feel comfortable with.
I those are very helpful guidelines, and I very much appreciate. I think that gives a lot of direction for what I think are some common struggles around this. I'm gonna go ahead and start shifting into specific medications, and I'll start with a broad question, which is what medications would you consider to be first line if you were thinking about the borderline personality disorder diagnosis? What are some of the classes of medications that come to mind first? And then I'll start asking about some specific medications that people have questions about.
Okay, so you said I should call out the slide number when we get there. So let me see if I can't do this. So if one looks at slide 11, which is entitled Dimensions of Psychopathology, if you went back up to the previous two slides, it lists a number of double-blind placebo-controlled studies from which 11 and eventually we'll get to slide 12, a kind of are the key slides. And basically, when you look at the double-blind placebo studies, people don't measure outcome in affective instability or anxiety or cognitive problems or impulsivity, but I've listed there in non-red the words in reviewing those 20-some-odd studies that we think, this is a study that I did with Erica Saunders, are kind of synonyms or get rolled up under affective instability. So you can look at depression, emptiness, euphoria, mania, identity disturbance, interpersonal sensitivity, or you can look at impulsivity as aggression, anger, hostility, impulsiveness. So if one thinks about borderline personality disorder, one can think about those four dimensions as being disrupted. Or there can be, you know, a disruption of emotion, emotion dysregulation, that people get anxious and then they get frozen in their anxiety, that at times they can distort and get paranoid, cognitive perceptual, and certainly impulsivity and aggression and anger. And if the next slide, going to slide 12, the on the left-hand side are eight systematic reviews or meta-analyses that included many of those, 23 or 24 studies that are on slides 9 and 10. And Erica Saunders and I sat down and tried to figure out, looking at how the people who did the reviews of those studies felt like the classes of medications that were effective. So the Lieb study thought that mood stabilizers were the most effective group for affective instability as well as for aggression and impulsivity. Yet at the same time, the Mercer group, which is a group out of Toronto, felt like both antipsychotics and mood stabilizers were equally effective for affective instability and mood stabilizers for aggression and impulsivity. So if you get down to the bottom, what Erica and I tried to do, and we didn't do this numerically, but we tried to get a sense from those eight reviews that I would say for affective instability, mood stabilizers would be the primary group of medications that one might want to use. Antidepressants can be used for depression, but only when the depression is part of a major depressive episode, a bona fide major depressive episode. Not that I'm depressed and want to kill myself at 10 o'clock in the morning and I'm feeling okay at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but that persistent more than 2 weeks sleep disturbance, appetite disturbance, depression. So for aggressive and impulsive symptoms, there's equal evidence, I think, for mood stabilizers and atypical antipsychotics, while for cognitive and perceptual distortions, dissociation, feeling paranoid, the atypical antipsychotics. Now, before we go further, I just want to say that the first step in deciding on which medication to use is to decide which of those dimensions of psychopathology are most disruptive for the patient. So is it affective instability, or is it aggressive impulsivity, or is it really cognitive distortion? Because if you wanted to give a medication for each one of those dimensions, then you're already putting somebody on two, if not three, medications. So much of what I was saying, when there's multiple diagnoses, you want to have a discussion with the patient as to which of these dimensions seems to be most disruptive most frequently for them, and that's the dimension that I would consider to treat initially with a pharmacologic agent. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it made sense to me, and I'm keeping an eye out for questions that come in. But on that slide, just to review it, on the summary, which is a summary of these different review articles, it was making those conclusions of mood stabilizers as often the choice for affective instability, mood stabilizers or antipsychotics in the next column, and that's all in the yellow across the bottom, antipsychotics under cognitive perceptual, antidepressants, mood stabilizers potentially, under anxiety, instability, and then global low-dose antipsychotics for kind of a global distress.
Right.
Good. So we'll see if other questions come in. We have a few that have come in related to mood stabilizers in particular. We have one person who writes that her son was recently put on lithium for BPD. Is there efficacy for
CPD symptoms, we had a different person send in a similar question, which was that their relative was first diagnosed bipolar and put on lithium, and then they were given the message, it's not actually bipolar, it really is borderline, but stay on the lithium. And we have some other questions about lithium specifically. Starting there, is that consistent with potentially with what we're seeing here on the table?
So let me put yes and no. There have been two controlled studies of lithium in borderline personality disorder, but they're old studies. And in both of those studies, that borderline personality disorder was not seen, lithium was not seen as an effective mood stabilizer. Though there is a reason for a person to stay on lithium, even if they have borderline rather than bipolar, because there is some evidence that lithium can have some anti-suicidal properties. There is a dispute about whether or not lithium does or doesn't have anti-suicidal properties. But if a person can tolerate lithium, and if they feel like it helps them stabilize their mood, then I would not take them off lithium, even though there are these two other studies, these two studies in the past that have said that it's not effective. The most effective mood stabilizers that we know for borderline personality disorder are, one, topiramate, though some people question the people who did the studies on topiramate, Topamax, and they're not convinced that Topamax or topiramate is really an effective mood stabilizer for borderline personality disorder. And then you're left with lamotrigine, Lamictal, or Depakote, valproic acid. But to some degree, and there are studies that show that valproic acid is effective, and there was one study that came out of McLean's to show that Lamictal was effective. But all of the mood stabilizers in general can have problematic side effects. So with Lamictal, you can always get a skin rash, and sometimes that can be a very damaging skin rash. But that the mood stabilizers in general as a group of medication seem to have a greater propensity to cause disturbances, abnormalities in fetuses than, let's say, the atypical antipsychotic. Not that we're looking at 20%, but all of the mood stabilizers seem to be able to affect or can have a greater chance of affecting unborn children. So when you think about the fact that we're looking at a population of individuals who have the potential of being pregnant or are in childbearing age, then one needs to be very, very cautious about this possible side effect that occurs with mood stabilizers. So then, I don't mean to muddy the waters, one might then want to back off and say, well, you know, the antipsychotic medications have some evidence, even for affective instability, let's use those instead. And that may be a good kind of path to follow, but the antipsychotic medication, particularly the atypical antipsychotics, can cause significant weight gain, though certainly Depakote can cause significant weight gain as well. And then do you want to give medications to someone who already has self-esteem issues, give a medication to someone that may cause them to gain weight, and that can't help a young woman's self-esteem? So making the decision is not simply an A to B arrow. It becomes complicated.
Yeah, it sounds like this just got a whole lot more complicated than looking at the table on page 12, because we've gone from which medications actually affect the symptoms to a whole array of complications. And even on the effectiveness, it sounds like there's a lot of controversy on, does this particular medication actually help? Does it not help?
So that's why I can get on my high horse, if I might, and say that we really need to be quite humble and thoughtful before we add medications, particularly when the medications aren't necessarily known to be greatly effective in this disorder, because there are all these other variables that can be taking place at the same time.
Yeah. So looking at the table, just trying to clarify some of what you've just been saying and thinking about these questions coming in, if I'm following this, if you had a discussion with individual with borderline, let's say it's a woman in her early 30s or something like that, and affective instability was agreed to be the dominant area of difficulty, there would still be some question about whether to begin with a mood stabilizer or not, simply because of some of the side effect profiles. Is that
right.
What I'm hearing?
Yes, yeah. And I would probably talk about Lamictal, Lamotrigine, and Depakote, valproic acid, with that individual, and talk about the side effects and talk a little bit about the studies that have been done on each one of those medications and try and decide if she was willing to get started on one of those two medications. And I would really very much want to make her aware of what I would consider to be the more troublesome side effects. I'm not worried about increased anxiety, but, you know, a skin rash with the Lamictal and particularly weight gain with the Depakote.
Yeah, and if we went back again, it was actually in the question came with the son, but someone who had been put onto lithium, would this be, if this was a case transferred to you, for example, would you want to review with them how well they're tolerating the lithium and whether it might be considered to switch to one of these other mood stabilizers?
Well, I'd want to know whether or not they thought it was helpful at all. And then if the person was uncertain about that, then I'd have a discussion about decreasing the lithium, and I would try and figure out some kind of way to measure how the individual's mood is stable or unstable as we lower the lithium. And then maybe give a two-week period of time on no medication and then try and decide if we should start a medication and should that be a mood stabilizer.
And that basic question of is the medication actually helping enough to continue? It sounds like that's one to regularly keep in mind, that the answer might be no medication when considering some of these medications.
I think that you'll find some clinicians to say that they've had patients who are on four or five medications, and when they took them off all four or five medications, not that life got better, but life didn't get worse.
Life didn't get worse.
Yeah.
One final question on lithium. I'm not sure about this. Someone was asking about whether there are safer forms of lithium, such as lithium orotate. I'm not familiar with that. Are there other lithiums that are safer?
Well, I looked that up, and that's a supplement. And I guess that my feeling about supplements, and the same would go for people who think about St. John's wort, is that when you have a supplement, you really have no idea what else is in that besides the presumed active ingredient. And you don't really know whether or not you're getting consistent dosing from pill to pill or bottle to bottle.
Okay, so that's a big word of caution.
Yeah, I mean, I would just go with the ones that are being made by the pharmaceutical industry, because at least you know that, presumably you know that they're pure, and someone's doing a bioequivalence, which means that the pill that I take today should be as effective as the pill that I take tomorrow.
And on the topic of supplements, one medication that does show up in your slides in one place, and we've had questions come in, is omega-3, and whether omega-3 should be considered either as an adjunct augmenting other medications or as a primary medication.
Sure. I think there are two studies that show that omega-3 can be has some effectiveness in borderline personality disorder. And also it probably has some cardiac effectiveness as well. So I would think that one could take omega-3 either as a primary medication or if you were taking another medication as well.
As a prescriber, would you ever suggest to someone perhaps start with omega-3 as a reasonable choice?
I would bring that up, particularly if I thought that the person really didn't want to be on any of the things that they would think would be, you know, chemicals and man-made kinds of things. So that's where I might start.
So as a lifestyle choice, if someone had that kind of value. We have a question about Adderall specifically being prescribed for depressive symptoms, not ADHD, because it's the only antidepressant that works for them. Can you speak to that, Adderall for depression, and then also specifically in borderline?
Well, I don't think Adderall is an antidepressant. You know, I think what it does is it gooses up the system and people have more energy. So, it's not something that I do because I think it also causes a lot of anxiety. And I guess I would go ask the question, if a person is feeling depressed and they're not responding to an antidepressant, do they have a major depressive episode or are they feeling chronically empty and lonely and bored and withdrawn? And if that's so, then I would want to address that as a symptom of borderline personality disorder and not try and deny it and then treat the person with a psychostimulant, which I think there are all sorts of problems with psychostimulants, so the psychostimulant manufacturers would not want you to believe that.
Okay.
So I'm not either for borderlines or non-borderlines. I'm not one to augment the fatigue of depression with a psychostimulant.
Okay, and another medication that people are expressing concerns about, we have someone asking, would you speak to the long-term use of anxiety medications, benzodiazepines, for BPD patients, pros and cons, withdrawal, et cetera? So long-term use of benzodiazepines.
So I think if there's anything that that's specifically stated in both the American Psychiatric Association guidelines as well as the guidelines that come out of Great Britain, is that benzodiazepines should be used only for a very short period of time. And there's two reasons for that. Number one is that people with borderline personality disorder get dependent on other people and they can get dependent on things. And so their propensity to get dependent on the benzodiazepines, which have dependence problems in themselves, even if you're not a borderline, is really great. And secondly, the fact that that often borderline patients have had problems with alcohol, and benzodiazepines are an alcohol equivalent. So I think that particularly one can use DBT and other skill-based therapies like CBT to work with an individual to have them manage their anxiety rather than to rely on a medication such as a benzodiazepine to manage the anxiety or to manage the emotional crises that come up.
Okay, thank you. There's someone asking you to speak about the role of Seroquel as a mood stabilizer, and they mention amounts in a normal or slow release. But in general, Seroquel as a mood stabilizer for BPD. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so Don Black, who is really a fine psychiatrist and a fine researcher, did a study, and I want to say it came out November and December last year, or January of this year in the American Journal, where he looked at, 100 and 300 milligrams, but it may be 200 and 300 milligrams, of quetiapine XL, so that's Seroquel XL, and found that it was a, a decent mood stabilizer, and also you know, had some antidepressant effects, and quetiapine is known to have antidepressant effects. My only objection to that study is that that the drug that they looked at was quetiapine XL, not regular quetiapine, because quetiapine XL is not yet generic, and the study was supported by AstraZeneca, the makers of quetiapine XL. And so I think everything in that study is a good study, except that I don't see any reason why a person ought to go pay a tier 3 copay when there's plenty of evidence that quetiapine that's not extended release is as effective and as long lasting as the extended release.
Thank you for the practical considerations in discussing this, and also alerting our audience, ourselves and our audience, to the limitations of single studies that come out. Would you speak to naltrexone for non-suicidal self-injury, such as cutting? Sometimes that gets recommended. And can you speak to whether that's something you would ever recommend?
So naltrexone is really an interesting story. There was a study done in Canada. There were actually studies done in the 90s in New York City, and studies that have been done in Germany that show that you really can use naltrexone to decrease the self-destructive behaviors, particularly the cutting. This gets back to my point that the psychopharmacologist and the patient need to have a discussion before any decision is made. There are patients who cut themselves in order to not move to become suicidal. So by cutting oneself, that there is a release of endorphins and opioids, and the dysphoria or the disconnection that patients feel that is so uncomfortable for them, you cut through, if I can make a pun, you cut through that bad feeling. And many patients will tell you they do that so that they don't become suicidal. So my only concern would be that if you eliminate that coping strategy, which is not one that Marsha Linehan or anybody would think is a decent coping strategy, but if you eliminate that, then patients may become more suicidal because they're not getting relief from the cutting. So that before that's given, you, the psychopharmacologist, the therapist, and the patient need to have a discussion about what one is going to do in order to replace that behavior. Because the behavior, as strange as it may seem, has a positive outcome for the patient. They do feel better. So if you eliminate the thing that helps them feel better, then what are they going to do instead?
So, but in a situation where someone is struggling with active cutting and where there is some replacement behaviors, where there is some precautions around the suicidality, it sounds like this is a medication that you might encourage for treating CPD with cutting?
Yeah, I would certainly discuss it, particularly if it was almost a kind of a compulsion to cut. You know,
okay,
it's driven to cut. There was a Paul Links put in a grant to the Canadian funding agency, which I reviewed, wanting to study this in a more systematic way. But Canada did not fund it, and that was really unfortunate, because there really is a 20-year history that points to being able to block the reinforcement that one gets from cutting.
Okay, I'm going to move on to some other broader topics related to family members with BPD. We had people ask about at what age signs of BPD begin to show, and also whether trends in suicidal ideation in youth are increasing. Can you speak to that?
So, you know, there's more and more studies that are being done, some in here in at Columbia University, and particularly those folks in Melbourne, and some in Montreal, that show that where we were reluctant to make the diagnosis of BPD in adolescence, I think there's more and more agreement that one can comfortably make the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder in someone as young as 16. But if one does that, one also needs to be willing to reevaluate as the person matures whether or not they still seem to meet the criteria for borderline personality disorder. But there's reasonably good evidence that one could make a valid diagnosis at age 16. The second question, I can't speak to the trends in suicidality or in actual completed suicides among teenagers. I know there's an article in the New York Times today about the kids in Palo Alto killing themselves at presumably a higher rate than they have in the past. I think that there are all sorts of things that teenagers have to face today that at least somebody my age, we didn't have to face. And some of those are the things, obviously, that social media makes available so that people can be bullied through social media. People can send pictures of other people in very embarrassing and compromising positions. And social media, there's tremendous pressure on kids, particularly in affluent communities, to go to the best school. And if you don't go to the best school, then your life is over. I mean, I think there are all sorts of pressures that that fall upon kids. And adolescents, if you take an adolescent in full bloom, all adolescents can look borderline. You know, they're emotionally reactive. Yeah. They can be in love one minute and feel like that the world's falling apart in another. So I think as we begin to share more information, there's 24-hour news cycles and other kinds of social media and expectations on kids. I just think that it's harder for them, and they don't really have the resilience and the defenses that somebody 5 or 6 or 10 years older might have acquired.
Thank you. There's some questions about adult children. So adult children who struggle with borderline. One parent of an adult child indicates that their son doesn't know that he has the diagnosis, the borderline diagnosis. And is this something that you'd recommend that someone be educated about having the diagnosis? And then perhaps related to that is what to suggest to family members who refuse to go for treatment or to try medication as a part of treatment.
Well, you know, it's been my experience. I mean, you can't really treat a borderline without telling a borderline you think that he or she is a borderline. I mean, you just can't do it. In some way, if you think the person's a borderline and you're not telling them, you're really being dishonest with them. And it's going to be very, very hard to engage with them honestly in a treatment if you, in some way, are being dishonest. I think that a lot of people don't want to tell patients that they think that, because I can't be 100% sure that anybody that I treat has what I think that they have. I have a pretty good index of suspicion. But I think that they're afraid that the patient is going to get angry with them. I make a joke and say that they're going to redecorate their office without asking for the office to be redecorated. But that never happens. In most instances, the patient will look at you and say, I knew I wasn't like those other depressed people. I knew I didn't fit in. Or, you know, I looked this up on the internet 5 years ago, but nobody that I've seen in treatment has been willing to engage with me around it and talk about it. So by telling them that, very often, very frequently, you are bonding with them and making a connection to them that can be very, very beneficial for you and for them as treatment progresses. In some instances, patients get very angry. They can call you less than loving names. And, you know, I often just say, well, look, I have no investment here in being right. But, and I take down my DSM and I say, let's go over the criteria. And let's see if we agree that this has been a problem for you. And more often than not, you'll agree on 80% of them. And then if the person says, oh, well, I'm not like that, I might say, well, you know, I have a different perception about that. But let's just put that criterion on the side. Let's go through the rest and let's go back. And I'll tell you why I have a perception that's different from yours. And I'll give you some examples of why I think that. But again, I'm not interested in being right. But I want us to be able to have a context in which to discuss what's going on with you. The adult child that refuses to go to treatment, oh, gosh.
Yeah. I wish we only had a few minutes left, but yeah, got any suggestions, any thoughts on that?
No, I guess that I might ask myself, if I were a parent, and I don't mean this by blaming the parent, I would ask myself, are there things that I do that allows my son or daughter to remain in this state of denial? Are there ways in which I'm supporting them in their denial? And what would happen if I remove those ways? But, you know, an adult, if they're not a danger to themselves or other people, that individual has a right to do what he or she wishes.
Mm. Thank you. One final question I'd like to put to you is prescribing for individuals who are at risk of suicide and may have histories of overdosing on their medications. Can you speak to that challenge of giving medications to someone who might use the medications for the problem?
I'd have a straightforward discussion with them. I mean, you can give the medications to a third party to handle the medication, but in some way you're trying to work with the patient on the patient being responsible for what it is that they feel and what it is that they do. So by giving the medications to a third party to administer to the patient, it's saying, well, I want you to be responsible, but not in this area. I'm too worried in this area. So I think there has to be a discussion about responsibility in using medications responsibly. I mean, if we're going to give medications to people, and they're continuing to drink or, you know, use other kinds of illicit substances, those are discussions that that when you give medications to someone, you expect them to use them responsibly and not to use your medications to act out over. That doesn't mean that they may agree and not do it. They may not agree, but I think that you have to address it directly. I'm worried about giving you these medications because I'm worried you're going to take them all.
So in terms of family members who might be listening in, who may have situations where they hold the medications, it sounds like, if I'm hearing you, the recommendation would be to try to help the person, help the patient be able to hold their own medication as part of.
Yes, but it seems to me that it needs to be a discussion that the family members, the patient, the prescribing individual, and the therapist have. So it's not just that the family members decide, okay, now I'm going to give the medication back, but I think all four of those, or if there's a mother and a father, all five of those people need to have a discussion and a plan about how to go forward.
Well, this has been a tremendously enlightening conversation. I feel like I've learned from this conversation, and I really hope that those listening in, either live or in the recording,
I'm actually sure they'll feel likewise. I want to thank you again, Dr. Silk, and also thank our listeners for joining this evening. Thank Drs. Andrea Gold and Lena Mayville on our call-in planning committee, Harry Hoffman, president of NEABPB, and a final thank you to our sponsors, the Gunderson Residents at McLean Hospital and Clearview Treatment Programs. Please consider joining us for our next call on April 19th, where we'll have Dr. Marina Bornova presenting on quantitative genetic studies of borderline personality disorder. Thank you so much, Ken.
Oh, and thanks for the opportunity, and hope everyone has a decent night.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you so much, Seth, for all that you did for this as well. Thank you to both of you.
Okay. Have a good night.
Good night.
Have a good night.